This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the current uptick in COVID cases and what a large analysis of long COVID patients teaches us about the ongoing neurological disease. Now, former President Donald Trump was indicted yesterday on 4 felony charges for his alleged role in attempting to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election. Here's special counsel Jack Smith.
Today, an indictment was unsealed, charging Donald J. Trump with conspiring to defraud the United States, conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and conspiring and attempting to obstruct an official proceeding. The indictment was issued by a grand jury of citizens here in the District of Columbia, and it sets forth the crimes charged in detail. I encourage everyone to read it in full.
We're taking a close look at the indictments, what's coming next in the case, and what consequences a conviction might have for the former president and current leading candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the most recent Trump indictment? Do you think the charges against him are justified? Does this indictment change or confirm your opinion of the former president? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Howard, I want to listen to more of Jack Smith's statement yesterday outlining the gravity of these charges.
The attack on our nation's capital on January 6th, 2021 was an unprecedented assault on the seat of American democracy. As described in the indictment, it was fueled by lies. Lies by the defendant targeted at obstructing a bedrock function of the U.S. government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election.
Howard, as compared to the other felony charges, the federal classified documents charges, the New York State charges over alleged misuse of campaign funds for hush money, how serious is this new set of indictments?
It's extremely serious and in at least two distinct ways. First of all, the crimes charged are major crimes. These are major felonies, and a conviction would be a very big deal. I mean, let me put my cards on the table. I simply cannot visualize an ex-president being led away in handcuffs to prison. But if anybody other than an ex-president were convicted of these crimes, that's certainly where they would end up. If they were convicted, I said. That's an assumption, obviously. The other reason, though, they're very serious is that Jack Smith has tailored these very carefully. He did not, for example, include a count about inciting the attacks of January 6th as part of his prosecution. He stepped to a series of charges, there are four of them in total, all based on the same set of facts. So he really only has to tell one story, so to speak. And all of them are based on facts. It's fairly easy to demonstrate. I mean, there'll be counter evidence, there'll be denials, but the fact-finding process doesn't need to become intensely long and complicated. Of all of the prosecutions, this may be the one, just by the way it's designed, that is most likely to proceed to trial and outcome before the 24 election.
Reading through the indictment, something that struck me up front is, first of all, Jack Smith says the former president had the right to make legal challenges in courts to the election outcome. He had the right to make false statements publicly about the election outcome. But he said he knowingly made those false statements in efforts to persuade members of state legislatures, the former Vice President Pence and others to change the outcome. How important is it that, as Jack Smith says, the president was aware that the statements he was making were false, that he was aware that these were election lies he was promoting?
That actually turns out to be an extraordinarily difficult question to answer with precision. Certainly, the mere fact that he said something false is not in and of itself, that's protected by the First Amendment. If it's just a statement that isn't part of a course of conduct. And when you hear some commentators saying, this is all about protecting Donald Trump's First Amendment rights, they're trying to claim that this is a prosecution just for making false statements. That's not how this thing is written, though. Smith was very, very careful to write an indictment that focuses on conduct and specifically criminal conspiracies. So now the question becomes, if Donald Trump, for example, as is charged, said false things to people in Wisconsin to get them to fraudulently act as electors in order to obstruct the operation of the U.S. government, right? That's one of the charges. How important is it that Trump knew that what he was saying was false? And the answer is almost certainly it will have to be shown that he was at least reckless. For a criminal conviction based on defrauding the United States, as opposed to the conspiracy to interfere with the operations of official functions, there it might be necessary to show that he actually knew the things he was saying were false. Along with the First Amendment defense that's been floated in the media, another one that's been floated has been what might be called the delusory defense, that Trump honestly believed he'd won the election, that all of these things that he was saying were true. Smith includes references to statements that Trump made indicating that's not the case, that he actually knew that he had lost the election, that what he was saying was not true. It's certainly very easy to show that people told Trump that what he was saying was not true, but there's a hazy area there in the middle. What happens if he says, I didn't believe anything I was told, I didn't think anything I was saying was false, I acted on the advice of some of my lawyers, even if other lawyers disagreed? Now, at a certain point, from Smith's perspective, the danger here is that Trump will be able to lay all the blame on his advisors and his lawyers, these six unnamed co-conspirators, and escape liability for himself by essentially saying, well, I just believed everything that that one or another of these people told me, and the most you can convict me of is choosing to believe the thing that was most favorable to me, which, of course, in and of itself is not a crime. The response will be that, of course, he went further. He organized, and it's interesting that the indictment focuses so heavily on the fake electors. Mm-hmm. That really is the core of the case, I think, that by himself and in conjunction with others, Trump went about arranging for fake electors to present themselves as real electors in a number of states, including Wisconsin. That conspiracy, everything that was involved in making that happen, that's really at the heart of these four charges. And that's where the question of what was Trump's state of mind is going to become so important.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, affiliate faculty at the Law School of UW-Madison, longtime professor of political science, looking at these new felony indictments, federal indictments against former President Trump over his actions after the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. If you've read through the indictments, what stood out to you? What is your reaction to these charges? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Howard, yes, definitely the false elector scheme really stood out as a through line here for this. The idea that the president's legal advisors were organizing this effort to have Republicans in states, including Wisconsin, sign papers saying, yeah, we're the electors, deceiving them, according to the indictment, in some cases saying, oh, no, this is only a contingency in case the courts flip this. But with a plan, the indictment states all along to present those to Vice President Pence and others to say, look, the election outcome from Wisconsin is in question. Look, there's two different sets of electors here. We got to do something about this. Can you talk through what you saw in that part of the indictment?
And actually, that part of the indictment is very, very interesting to me. So Smith identifies and quotes from three memos at three different times having to do with this scheme, internal memos by Trump advisors. And the first one, the earliest one, said, let's set this up just in case. And that's what some of the fake electors were told they were doing. That's the misleading part you just mentioned. They were told, don't worry, we're not going to pretend you're the real electors. You know, we're only going to have this slate prepared in case there comes to be a need to have a new slate of electors because the outcome is overturned. But then there were a second and a third memorandum. And by the time you get to the third memo, the plot is quite specifically to have Pence, who's assumed to be in on the deal, in his role as vice president, get on the floor of Congress and declare that the fake electors are actually the real ones and accept them, and on that basis award the election to Trump. Now, that goes way beyond the original version or the version of the first memo and the version that was told to some of the fake electors, and again, a version that I've heard bruited about in the media that said, no, this was only a contingency plan to have electors prepared in case the electoral outcome in these states, like including Wisconsin, should be overturned. But the internal memos show that by the time the date of January 6th got closer, the team had pivoted and were planning to actually present these fake electors as real. And that's the dishonesty, fraud, and deceit part. And I think it would be very hard for Trump to pretend he didn't know that that was fake. Even if you accept his word for it that he believed the election was stolen, he believed there was massive fraud, right down the line, he certainly was aware, having read these memos, that these were not the official lawful electors and that he was involved in a plan to have Mike Pence, on his behalf, pretend that they were, and thus, well, in popular parlance, we would say steal the election, but in the legal terminology here, interfere with a lawful federal government function, by which the results of elections are collected and counted. I think that's a very difficult count for Trump to get out of. It's not just about false statements. It's about an extended effort involving a lot of people over an extended period of time to organize all these fake electors and to have people reach out to them and to talk to state officials and to have people on his team talk to each other. This fits the classic description of a large-scale conspiracy in a complex criminal scheme. And there's no question that the scheme was unlawful. And what these memos show is that there was an unlawful intent. There was an intent to use this scheme to achieve unlawful ends. That comes pretty close to making this case. And that's one of the reasons I say I think this case is interesting and potentially dangerous for Trump, because the narrative is pretty clear and the facts are very well established. So the only real question for a jury will be, how do you interpret these facts?
Right. I want to bring in a caller on, I think, on the fake elector issue. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. Frankly, I believe that Josh Call, our attorney general, has been markedly deficient with respect to prosecuting to the fullest extent of Wisconsin law the false electors. And that in addition, one of them was given some kind of free pass to continue participation in the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Don't you believe that the case against Trump, as outlined in this indictment, would be much stronger if we already had convictions on the books?
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Howard, Attorney General Call's colleague in Michigan, has charged the counterparts in that state. I imagine if I were one of the people who'd signed the elector, I'd point in the indictment and say, no, look there. It says they deceived us into thinking we were doing a contingent declaration here, not as part of the scheme. What do you think of what Tom had to say, Howard?
I understand Tom's position. I don't actually think that Wisconsin's prosecutions against fake electors strengthens the case against Trump, and partly for the reason that you just said. As Smith acknowledges in the indictment, in at least some cases, and I want to emphasize some cases, he believes it to, his office believes it to be the case that these fake electors were deceived. In some cases, they were not. So each one of those electors' trials will involve a separate finding of fact of whether they knew what they were doing was illegal and so on. The fact that is relevant for the prosecution of Trump is that he attempted to organize and successfully organize this effort to have them sign off on these documents. Whether or not they were committing crimes or knew they were committing crimes doesn't alter the fact that he was involved in a conspiracy to use them to violate federal law. And that's why these are really separate legal proceedings. I do think it was shocking that one of those electors was allowed to continue to participate on the Election Commission. I suspect some prosecutions at least are coming against fake electors in Wisconsin, but they are, while there's the story, their story is the heart of the prosecution, but their conduct is not. It's the conduct of the president himself that's at issue.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We're talking to law and politics expert Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison, looking at yesterday's indictments released of former President Donald Trump for his alleged attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the legal side of these charges? Do you have thoughts on the political side? Do you think Donald Trump should end his campaign for president if convicted? Does this indictment impact how you would cast your vote if he stays in the race, either in the primary or a general election? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison, looking at the most recent indictment of former President Donald Trump for federal felony charges related to his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about these indictments, your reaction after hearing about them, or maybe reading them yourself. What do you want to see happen next? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I just want to make sure I understood you correctly. If I find a lawyer that says what I'm doing is legal, then regardless of what I'm doing, I'm off the hook. Did I understand that correctly? And then my second question would be, so if I had enough money, I could just pay a lawyer to say what I was doing was legal, meaning that if you're rich, you can do whatever you want.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Howard, former President Trump has made an argument along those lines, like, hey, I was getting great advice from fantastic legal minds saying that what I was doing is legal. I don't think that's a get-out-of-jail-free card in any case. How limited or successful could that argument be?
Yeah, there's no really good answer. So it's called an advice of counsel defense. If I was told by a lawyer that what I'm doing is perfectly legal, am I not permitted to just rely on that legal advice? And the answer is sometimes, but not always. So we mentioned there are six unnamed co-conspirators. From the description of the indictment, it's quite clear who at least five of them are. And they're mostly his lawyers, Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, and Jeffrey Clark. And a guy named Ken Cheeseborough. Sorry, I left him out. You know, all of them were lawyers. All of them were exchanging legal advice. It is true that Trump was being told things by, for example, Sidney Powell that his other lawyers were telling him were nuts. And he will argue that he chose to simply believe Powell. There's a couple of limits to the get-out-of-jail-free card, though. One, the person involved, Trump, has to not know that what he's being told is absurd, is nonsense. And here, you know, as I say, there are references to conversations and statements he's made that indicate that he knew he had lost the election and he knew this was false. Two, the advice of counsel defense only works for legal advice, right? So if someone says to the president, it is entirely within your powers under the Constitution to tell Mike Pence, you know, not to accept the ballots or something, the electors, that might be protected legal advice. But it does not extend to things like, for example, assertions of fact. If one of the lawyers said, you know, there is absolute proof of massive fraud, that's not legal advice. That's not any more special coming from a lawyer than it would be from coming from someone else. And this gets back to our question of what state of mind has to be shown. Does it have to be proved that Trump knew he was lying or only that he was reckless in making false statements? And that may be different for different counts. The third thing about the defense of counsel thing, and Jerry asked if I have enough money, can I just pay a lawyer to say whatever I want him to? Possibly, but that lawyer may end up going to prison. And, you know, what's interesting about these unnamed co-conspirators, at least five of whom are lawyers, is that there is a suspicion that Trump will try to say this was all the lawyer's fault and try to dump everything on them. Each one of them is facing possible prosecution, and we have to assume that Smith's office is trying to put pressure on each one of them to turn and provide evidence against Trump in order to try and get themselves out of trouble. And they're not named now, but they can always be named later. This gets to yet another complication of the whole deal, which is, would Trump take a stand at trial? Almost certainly he would not want to, because on cross-examination, he can be confronted by all the various statements that he's made, indicating that he knew he had lost the election, or indicating, you know, that he was saying false things or engaged in illegal conduct and so on. On the other hand, if he doesn't, any of these co-conspirator lawyers who turns on him can get up and testify that, yes, he knew perfectly well what he was doing was illegal. So it's a very risky situation. What is usually a shield, the attorney-client privilege, becomes a source of vulnerability if you're engaged in a criminal conspiracy with your lawyers, because privilege does not cover criminal acts, and that is entirely what's being alleged here.
Thanks a lot.
That was a long answer. I hope it made sense.
No, interesting answer too. Thanks, and a great question. Thanks for that call. I want to give a listen to a central figure here, former Vice President Mike Pence, now a competitor in the presidential race with former President Trump. Here he is responding to the charges earlier today.
Sadly, the president was surrounded by a group of crackpot lawyers. that kept telling him what his itching ears wanted to hear. And while I made my case to him of what I understood my oath to the Constitution to require, the president ultimately continue to demand that I choose him over the Constitution.
In her last few moments, Howard, and we could end up with the former vice president being asked to testify in this case. A lot of the indictment draws from his notes taken at the time. He is a central figure in the story told by the indictment. Can you talk about what might happen at a trial?
He will certainly be called to testify. As you mentioned, there's too much in this indictment to get through quickly. The New York Times has a very nice version of the text, and I encourage listeners to look it up. It has a nice commentary in the margins explaining what's going on in different places. Pence took contemporaneous notes about conversations that he was part of with Trump and the other advisors. It's not clear to me reading the indictment whether he was actually taking notes in the room or jotted them down immediately afterwards. But the word contemporaneous is used, indicating it was effectively at the same time. And that's important because that goes to the reliability and accuracy of the record. Those notes are at the core of several of the allegations, including references in Pence's notes to Trump saying things that indicated he knew what he was saying was false, or indicated that he knew what he was doing was illegal. So I think there's no question Pence would be called as a witness. There would probably be an attempt to have those notes introduced. It might not work if Pence is available, but he could then be called as a witness and asked about his statements. And Pence's public statement that you just played for us suggests to me, at least, that he is quite willing to stand up and say that ex-President Trump was involved in a criminal conspiracy. You really, I think, have to go back to either Iran-Contra or before that, Watergate, to see a moment where you have a president involved in such a group of people making a criminal enterprise. This is an extraordinary charge. Of all the charges against Trump, this one obviously is the most important. This one has to do with the attempt to steal the election and corrupt the democratic process. And the indictment lays out a very powerful and very damning case that says that Trump was at the head of nothing less than a criminal conspiracy. And I think it will be difficult for him to defend himself against these charges.
Thanks to our guest, Howard Traber from UW-Madison, looking at these new indictments against former President Donald Trump. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the latest on COVID-19 with new booster vaccines on the way, plus new research on the impacts of long COVID. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about home.
Feeling like you're different from your peers can have a big impact on your self-acceptance. But as Miriam Brabham of Green Bay tells us, a nurturing community helped her learn how to love her hair. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
When I was young, I hated my hair. It spent most of its time tightly pulled into lopsided buns, surrounded by a halo of curly flyaways. In those early years, my curls were traumatized. They were dehydrated and unappreciated, and they were a visual reminder of what I didn't know and how I didn't fit in. As a multi-ethnic Black girl who was also a Messianic Jew, 9-year-old me saw my curls as yet another thing that othered me. At a North Chicago YMCA, I would watch the other girls after swim class with envy. Passing small combs through their wet, straight hair, they would sigh and huff as they started from the top of their heads and found resistance at the ends. These girls would finish detangling their whole head in 5 minutes. After swim class, I didn't have time to wash my thick hair. While the smell of Pantene and Suave filled the air, I used the water to help me gather my curls into an outstretched scrunchie. These rebellious curls, stinking of chlorine and a lack of information, would begin to clump together into impossible knots, almost as if they were so suffocated by the world that they coiled together for comfort. I hated my hair. It was time, effort, and a major contributor to my imposter syndrome collection. Not white enough, not Black enough, not Jewish enough, and yet too much. As I got older, the war with my hair became bitter. Temporary dyes, perms, and massive amounts of heat were met with split ends, chemical burns, and tension alopecia. Big chop after big chop left me at a shady hair braiding salon under the tracks on the north side of Chicago, where a woman used nail glue instead of hair glue and some overpriced box braids. Cutting out multiple braids, explaining why you shouldn't say good hair, and having monoracial people laugh at my ignorance left trauma residue all over my coils. The age of peace began when I started talking nice to my hair, instead of verbally berating it, and subsequently, myself. I learned so much about my hair while studying abroad in Botswana, Africa. The people were not shy or reserved in their comments and suggestions. They also didn't see me as separate from themselves. I just didn't know how to do my hair. The Botswana people taught me to love myself and my hair. I began to see my curls as an intrinsic part of myself. These curls can be playful springs that bounce in a sweet summer breeze. They can be strong, wide coils that keep the moisture to themselves and observe the world from scarves that set them on high. These curls can refuse to be tamed. They can go their own way, laughing at edge control and headbands alike. They can lay gently around my face. These curls define themselves and can easily change depending on the day and humidity. They have personality, and not shockingly, it's very similar to my own. So yes, there is trauma wrapped up in these curls. But like trauma in any of us, I am healing with love, time, and hair oil.
Miriam Brabham is a multicultural student success manager at UW Green Bay. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the numbers aren't huge, but there's been an uptick in the number of COVID cases and hospitalizations this summer. Helix, the company that's helped the CDC keep track of virus variants, has seen cases rise at least 30% from June to July, from a pretty low starting point. We're talking about why we may be seeing this uptick, what it might mean for the fall, and we'll look at the new booster vaccine expected for this fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or anyone you know had COVID recently? What do you want to know about current case numbers and the fall boosters? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
What are we seeing in COVID numbers when it comes to cases and hospitalizations lately?
Yeah, well, since June, right about when schools closed for the year and summer travel season began, wastewater surveillance and, you know, people taking trips to emergency departments around the country, all those data indicated that cases were beginning to increase. And around mid-July, hospitalizations also began to increase. And we haven't seen an increase in deaths yet, but that's something to monitor and see what might happen in the coming weeks to months.
And to put things in perspective, we're not at this point anyway returning to the bad old days with really high numbers of hospitalizations. Do I have that right?
That's right. There is a lot of immunity out there, but some of that immunity that came from maybe a past infection and from boosters, which were, you know, offered beginning last fall, a lot of that immunity begins to wane. And as people are gathering and traveling and seeing each other, you get this recipe for more spread.
One of the big questions here, is this a summertime blip or is this foreshadowing maybe a bigger seasonal increase in the fall? What are we watching for to see what the answer is going to be?
Yeah, again, it's not surprising that it's increasing because people are increasingly returning to normal, traveling, moving around, seeing each other. Obviously, most people are not wearing masks. Some people are, and that's great for their to reduce their personal risk, but most people aren't. There is a lot of immunity to help protect people, but that wanes over time. And so coming into the fall, it's a good time to, you know, begin talking about the next booster that will be available.
I want to get into the booster in just a moment, but I want to talk about who might still be vulnerable as COVID numbers pick up a little bit. As you mentioned, a lot of people vaccinated. A lot of people may have had a prior infection, were mostly less susceptible. But it seems like there's a group of people, in many cases, vaccinated but vulnerable because of a combination of age and pre-existing health conditions. Who should we be watching for the most when it comes to vulnerability to a bump up in COVID numbers?
Yeah, I mean, the people at risk for severe COVID are going to be those who are immunocompromised. For them, you know, the vaccines don't take as well as someone whose immune systems are more intact. People who are elderly as well, simply because with age comes a decline in one's immunity and ability to mount an immune response. And like you said, somebody who has lots of comorbidities is at risk for severe disease. And all of those individuals really should do what they can to prevent getting an infection.
Talking to Ajay Sethi from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest COVID news, including, as you mentioned, Ajay, a new fall line of boosters coming out, I think anticipated to hit the health clinics and more in September, likely. There's some changes in the design in these new vaccines. What are we looking at?
Yeah, so we have had the bivalent booster, where half the vaccine is the ancestral strain, the original strain of SARS-CoV-2. And then added in there was the variant at the time when those boosters were developed, the BA5 variant. In the fall, we're not going to have a bivalent booster. We're going to have a booster with just the latest strain, XBB.1.5. And the XBB variant, the family of variants, are circulating. And so it'll give people the most protection against what's circulating at the moment.
Looking at these variants, as I understand it, well, first of all, you mentioned the ancestral, the original COVID. We're not so much seeing that anymore. It's these newer variants. Why this 1.5? I gather it isn't, you know, a dominant strain right now, but is it similar enough to, I guess, the variety, the grab bag of different variants out there that it should be helpful?
Yeah, the recommendation for XBB 1.5 is because that's where the data are from. That's what's been evaluated, and it mounts a good immune response when boosted with that. Sure, it is on a decline and being replaced with other variants in the XBB family, but they are very similar to one another. So the immune system won't have such a different response, whether it's XBB 1.5 or something else in that family.
People might be listening thinking, okay, well, should I get a new booster? Shouldn't I? I don't know. Who would be at the top of your list for people who should answer that question? Yes, and probably as soon as you can.
Yeah, the CDC is going to make a recommendation on who should get boosted. And the expectation, of course, is anybody who's elderly, immunocompromised, people at most risk. For the general population who don't fall in those categories, we'll see what the CDC recommends. If somebody's indicated, certainly they should get boosted.
One big question all along, and I don't know if there's an answer yet, is COVID going to become a seasonal illness? Like we know in Wisconsin, roughly, when cold and flu is going to come along. Has COVID settled into a pattern like that, or is that still a big question mark?
Yeah, still a question mark. It hasn't been seasonal yet. I mean, the summer uptick is an example where we wouldn't expect to see a lot of respiratory virus transmission in the summer, and yet we're seeing this uptick. Maybe it's an early increase for what's about to come in the fall. Maybe it'll decline and then it'll peak later. We haven't seen a seasonal pattern. And, you know, as an epidemiologist, I say we need a few seasons before we can declare something as seasonal. So for now, I think just keeping track of cases, hospitalizations are important and see where the rises may be occurring.
And getting back to vaccinations before I let you go, Ajay, a lot of people got the original vaccines. It seems like there's been a diminishing return in terms of the number of people getting successive boosters. Pretty low uptake in the scope of things for the latest round. Are you hopeful that more people will seize on the opportunity for this new one in the fall?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, there's a lot of immunity out there. Over 96% of people have antibodies to this virus, whether it came from vaccines, whether it came from an infection, or a combination of both. A lot of people who have had recent infection might not feel motivated to get a booster since they have immunity from that form. But all immunity wanes. So it's important to maybe have a conversation with your doctor and discuss what your individual vulnerability is and whether the booster is right for you. And of course, if it's recommended, there's a reason for it, why it's recommended for you, and it's a good idea to get it.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor, Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about a recent increase in COVID cases and some upcoming vaccine boosters. Coming up, a lot of people who have had COVID-19 experience longer-term symptoms. We'll check out some new research on long COVID. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about longer-term impacts of COVID? Have you experienced them? Are you experiencing them yourself or someone in your family? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about COVID-19. Now we're taking a look at a new analysis of patients with long COVID. Long COVID is the third most common neurological condition in the United States. It continues to be a problem long after the worst of the pandemic went away. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to share an experience you had with longer-term impacts of COVID-19, or if you have a question about diagnosis, treatment, research on long COVID, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Mark Sala is an assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and co-director of the Northwestern Medicine Comprehensive COVID-19 Center, which provides care for and conducts research on long COVID. Dr. Sala, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sorry, we had a line get crossed there. Sorry about that, Dr. Sala. So first of all, can you talk about this study? You treat patients with long COVID there at Northwestern. This study looks at more than 1,800 patients who have been treated there. What are some of the most significant things you found?
Yeah, thanks for highlighting this. So indeed, so our COVID recovery center, this comprehensive COVID center that we have at our hospital system here, what we've done is during really the early phases of the pandemic, we tried to take in as many individuals as we could who had persistent symptoms from the virus. Usually we define that as over 30 days after the infection, having persistent or new symptoms that can be attributed to COVID. And so in our circumstance, our paper describes really kind of our configuration of our center, what we found to be helpful in case other hospitals or systems across the country might find that valuable. And then the other component to our manuscript here is we really take a look at those 1,802 people and just kind of explain which different specialties among our 12 different specialties who take care of these individuals at our center. What was it like for, did people need to see more neurology, more pulmonology, more cardiology, and a lot of those practice patterns. And some of the conclusions there were that 85% of the people that we did see at our center needed to see either neurology, cardiology, or pulmonology, respectively. And those are predominantly where people have most of their persistent symptoms, as it turns out, with a smattering of other specialties involved, including ENT, dermatology, GI, for other ailments. And then when we looked at categories of types of people that we saw, we tried to really separate those out who were in the ICU versus those who maybe were in the hospital but not critically ill, and then those who were not hospitalized. And in fact, 80% of our entire cohort of people were never hospitalized for their illness of acute COVID. And we found that when doctors made decisions about what types of tests they needed, so as a pulmonologist, if I see someone who has persistent shortness of breath after COVID or maybe a cough that just won't go away, when we order directed testing like CT scans, pulmonary function testing, a really high proportion of people end up having abnormalities on those tests. So for an example, someone who was maybe never hospitalized for their COVID infection, just as one example here, we can see sometimes one in five people who are not hospitalized for COVID might have CT scan abnormalities that show some sign of inflammation or fibrosis in their lung tissue. So the point of our, the punchline really of kind of our paper and our findings was that multiple eyes from multiple specialties on these individuals who have persistent ailments, it tends to benefit them to have a lot of different doctors looking at them in the setting.
And that speaks, I think, to the pernicious nature of COVID-19, especially including in its long COVID form. At first we thought, oh, this is, you know, a particularly bad, but this is a respiratory virus. the virus did a lot of different things to different bodily systems. And that sounds like that's playing out in what you're seeing in long COVID.
Yeah, I mean, one might argue that, in fact, while the most severe morbidity and mortality that came about early in the pandemic was indeed pneumonia and the consequences from it, but that the longer lasting issues now are mainly manifestations such as brain fog, cognition problems, and really just profound fatigue for a lot of people. So the landscape has changed. I mean, vaccines and how the virus mutated changed a lot of what we've been seeing. But yeah, you're right, though. I mean, the myriad ways in which this has afflicted people and for the time and trajectory has been otherwise pretty unexpected.
Let's bring on a caller. Jessica is with us in Appleton. Jessica, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Jessica?
So I just wanted to talk about, like, my experience with COVID. And honestly, like, it's been 3 years since I had it, and my life has changed dramatically for the worse. You know, my brain fog, I'm fatigued, and it's not just those things. It's also that, like, when I get sick now, I get really sick. I am, like, laid up in bed from colds. Like, our immune system is not a muscle that we need to flex. Like, if something doesn't kill you, it doesn't necessarily make it stronger. It might just make you weaker for the next thing to kill you. Especially since we have, you know, in this country, we have not, our excess deaths have not gone down to our pre-pandemic levels. So that would kind of suggest that long COVID is something that we're kind of just pushing under the rug.
Jessica, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Sala, unfortunate for Jessica, but I'm guessing this is the kind of story you hear a lot from patients there at Northwestern.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things I would highlight there is that it sounds like, based on her three-year duration, she was probably one of the individuals early in the pandemic who acquired the illness, very likely pre-vaccine era sort of thing. And so, but that in itself is actually not unheard of. And in fact, you know, it's actually quite common where someone got an infection 3 years on, they're still struggling with a lot of the cognitive issues, especially, and this idea of having subsequent flares when someone gets a respiratory illness or you know, on a given day is also a pretty stereotype phenomenon as well.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. And Dr. Sala, I want to focus on one thing she mentioned, fatigue. And I think sometimes I hear the word fatigue and think, oh yeah, we're all a little sleepy sometimes. As I, at least in things I've read, the people experiencing long COVID, fatigue means something pretty different and really life-limiting in some cases. How big a symptom has that been?
Yeah, there's two things I would separate out there. One is fatigue, where sometimes people describe it as, you know, they'll be going about their day and then they just feel a profound, you know, a need to just kind of lie down and maybe not even sleep, to be honest with you, just lie down and take a break for a second there. There's that fatigue. And then there's also something I would just kind of be a little bit more nuanced about, which is what I call exercise intolerance, where a lot of people maybe were very previously very athletic, marathon runners in some cases, where they really cannot get back to their prior pace or clip when it comes back to activity. And sometimes when they do try to push it to 100% of what they knew as their baseline is when they can really suffer for the next several days. And that's actually kind of a phenomenon we refer to as exercise intolerance or post-exertional malaise, where that sort of activity kind of hits them hardest. So two slightly different twists on the same concept, but definitely important to kind of tease out as the provider.
Dr. Sala, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for sharing your research with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Mark Sala, Assistant Professor of Pulmonary and Critical Care at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Co-Director of the Northwestern Medicine Comprehensive COVID-19 Center. He talked to us about a new analysis of just over 1,800 long COVID patients who have been treated at the center. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, getting older can bring a lot of changes and challenges. Get a lot of advice on meeting those challenges with the author of the new book, The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. And Wisconsin is expected to be a swing state in the presidential election again. Why has Wisconsin stayed on the seesaw while so many states have moved on to the Democratic or Republican columns? Longtime state politics writer joins the show. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.